This is when individuality and flexibility makes the most sense. Teachers know their students best and should have the freedom to teach how they like. This is the catch-22 with standardized tests. How do we find a balance between agreeable standards and high rigor? Beyond limited curriculum in the classroom are disciplinary policies that are quick to criminalize rather than correcting or helping guide student behavior. As we've touched on previously, zero tolerance policies were initially created as a response to a nationwide crackdown on weapons, drugs, and violent behavior in schools. They are enforced when students commit what is called exceptional misconduct. In Washington State, each individual school district is allowed to define exactly what exceptional conduct means. In some instances, the definition has expanded to include a zero tolerance approach to truancy, gangs, and even harassment. If a student breaks a rule that falls under the purview of zero tolerance policy, the punishment is severe and formal. Your options for redress, if you feel you are wrongly punished, are limited. Within the Seattle School District, there are 9 categories of exceptional misconduct that warrant suspension and immediate referral to police. A few of these offenses range from trespassing on school property, to intimidation of school authorities, to fighting, to the use of toys as a weapon, to pulling fire alarms, or for partaking in gang or hate group activity.
Black and brown students, because of racial discrimination, are perceived to be more violent and disruptive than white students. The problem with zero tolerance policies is that they are supposed to objectively punish students for crimes which are subjectively determined by adults. We spoke with Annie Lee, the executive director of Team Child, which is a group of attorneys who provide free legal representation and advice to help youth assert their civil legal rights and to access community-based services that help them meet their basic needs. For example, Team Child would help students get back into school, secure safe and stable housing, obtain health care and mental health services, or to access other kinds of public support. Team Child serves roughly 1,000 young people in Washington State with 7 different offices. They've existed since 1997.
When I interviewed Annie, I asked her a question I'm sure she gets all the time. What are students most often suspended for? I was curious. I wanted to know if it was fighting or something like drug use, but Annie was quick to reframe the question. Instead of talking about an actual offense that a student had committed, she spoke to the reaction that adults had toward the incident. She believes, in a lot of cases, adults overreact. Students misbehave without knowing the severe consequences of their actions, and strict policies jack up the stakes, especially when it comes to issues or incidents around gangs. To some adults, it is not a crime to loiter in the hallways with a group of friends. You could be yelling loudly and goofing around, but to another adult, this could look like a gang and you could be perceived as harassing another student. Under a zero tolerance policy, all of these students would be suspended with no opportunity to explain the circumstance.
There's no evidence that suggests that youth of color commit offenses at higher rates than white kids, yet they are criminalized at much higher rates. What we mean when we say criminalized is that these offenses under zero tolerance policies have to be reported to the police department. Young people may think they could only get in trouble with school administrators, but when in reality, they are sent directly into the juvenile court system. This is an example of the ways in which the legacy of Jim Crow still exists in the classroom, through the criminalization of black and brown youth. Zero tolerance policies were intended to keep students safe, but instead have done exactly the opposite.
Nationally, 20% of black youth are suspended and 5% are expelled. In contrast, 9% of white students are suspended, but only 1% are expelled. In Seattle, the national trend is similar, with 28% of African American middle school students suspended compared to only 7% of white students. Evidence suggests that roughly 1/4 of students of color who are suspended or expelled don't return to the classroom. For white students, the same is true, but for only less than 1% of students.
We've seen how Jim Crow-like policies are keeping kids out of the classroom, but they're also pushing them through a pathway to jail. What happens to kids when they're not in the classroom? How are youth of color experiencing Jim Crow outside of school? Youth of color who have been expelled from public schools because of discriminatory policies are at risk of being targeted on the street for the very same reasons. It's not news to most that racial profiling exists in America. We're referring to a police person's use of an individual's race or ethnicity as a key factor in determining whether or not to engage in law enforcement. Racial profiling is a component to the long-standing Jim Crow legacy in this country, where black and brown bodies are targeted and highly policed in public spaces. Along with race, I would argue that age is also a factor in discriminatory discipline enforcement. As a society, we often assume the worst of young people. Racial profiling on the streets is where young students of color move through the next section of the pipeline towards prison.
One major policy that is often overlooked that ends up having severe consequences on young students of color are school zone drug laws. School zone drug laws are those that increase penalties of an offender for committing crimes near a school. In Washington state, school zone laws enhance a standard drug sentence by 2 years, as well as double the penalty for the manufacturing, selling, delivering, and/or possession of drugs when activity happens within 1,000 feet of a school. Washington goes a step farther by extending the increased sentencing for areas near public parks, public housing projects, school bus route stops, and civic centers. These laws, which were intended to keep students safe from drugs, oftentimes put youth of color and low-income students at a greater risk of being harshly policed and sentenced. With these types of policies, even a minor nonviolent drug offense committed within a drug-free zone results in a harsh punishment. In 2005, in Pierce County, African Americans were 3 times more likely than whites to receive the school zone enhancement when convicted of drug offenses. As we've discussed in the previous podcast, students of color don't use drugs at a higher rate than their white peers. So one of the ways this unequal outcome could be explained is by taking a closer look at geography. If schools, civic centers, parks, and housing developments are the targeted areas for increased and stricter drug regulations, these policies are more likely to affect individuals living in metropolitan environments where communities of color and low-income communities are concentrated.
Students of color, when in fact in trouble with the police, have been shown to receive harsher penalties within the school system and also outside of its walls. We've read studies that show youth of color are more likely to be tried as adults than their white peers in the criminal justice system. In Seattle, a city with a comparatively small African-American population, 64% of black youth who have been detained were actually prosecuted compared to only 33% of white youth. This results in a large segment of youth of color behind bars, a trend that mirrors and foreshadows the mass incarceration of people of color that Michelle Alexander writes about.
In recapping, we're beginning to see how disparities in educational attainment, in discipline in schools, and in convictions outside the classroom build on each other to create overwhelming differences in school experiences for some students.
As a tutor in the King County Juvenile Detention Center, I got to witness firsthand the learning environment of convicted students, and they often get shorthanded when it comes to their education while in juvie. The staff-to-student ratio is extremely high, and detention school teachers are often overwhelmed with the large numbers of students, each who have differing learning needs. Many of the students in detention come with learning and behavioral disabilities that teachers are not always equipped to handle. The quality of education in the detention school is compromised by the fact that the students range so much in age and grade levels. Students from ages 10 to 17 are stuck in the same classroom and expected to learn the same things the same way. Also, a student's length of stay varies. Youth can be detained anywhere from 6 months to over a year. It becomes nearly impossible for teachers and students to have the kind of learning environment necessary for any substantial learning. Personally, working at the detention center was a rewarding experience because I was able to connect with students and support them. But during my time there, I witnessed a lot of opportunities to improve the system.
There are a number of reasons schools deny re-entry to students returning from the juvenile justice system. For example, if a student was convicted of a crime that were perceived as dangerous to others, they may be asked to prove that they had gone through a behavioral readjustment, such as an anger management course. Regardless of the crime, that's no reason to deny a student an education. We found that students are mandated by law to attend classes until the age of 16. Yet after a student is expelled or deemed truant, It was confusing to pinpoint exactly who was responsible for re-enrolling that student.
One article we read suggested that district administrators encourage students to enroll in alternative education programs because the logistical aspect of re-enrolling into a standard public school was cumbersome. Some students just dropped out. When students do re-enroll, they often find they earned far fewer credits while in a detention center than in a regular public school. Classes held in detention centers are sporadic, often disrupted by behavioral difficulties. They're underfunded, with little classroom space and outdated materials. This contributes to a higher dropout rate of students of color who have been involved in the juvenile justice system because they've had to take remedial courses to catch up to their peers. A national study concluded that 66% of students who were formerly in custody eventually dropped out of school after their release.
We can see how the right doors close and how the wrong ones open for many students. While these policies and practices are not explicitly making a racialized statement on an individual level, they make a grand impact when viewed from an institutional level. The real problematic connections between the school and prison systems are manifested in the continued, lifelong disenfranchisement of youth of color.
Access to a quality public education should be a right for every student, regardless of race, class, sex, or even former incarceration. By pushing kids out of school, we're not only robbing them of a quality education, but also robbing them of serious life chances. An education system infested with discriminatory discipline policies restricts the future economic and social mobility of youth. Having a criminal record makes it extremely difficult to find a job and own a home, which makes an individual more reliant on social services. The irony is that these very services are harder to qualify for if you have a criminal record. Lifelong restrictions for past criminal offenders are a contemporary manifestation of the Jim Crow legacy in our education system. When black and brown students are pushed out of the classroom and into the juvenile justice system, we maintain a Jim Crow-like socioeconomic and racial caste system in the U.S. where people of color remain in inferior positions. One lawyer we spoke with asked candidly, "Who teaches the bad kids?" The students that need the most help are the ones we end up pushing through the court system.
If this information jars you, you're not alone. Students, teachers, parents, and policymakers alike are working on strategies to ease the gap and are finding what we'd all expect. The complicated and deep-rooted social issues require multifaceted and well-funded policy approaches. It doesn't help that there seems to be a proverbial passing of the torch when it comes to discussing whose feet we're going to hold to the fire. If you're looking for a solution, it varies depending on who you ask. If you ask a student how to fix the opportunity gap, they will most likely tell you that the single most important factor in their education is their teacher. The culture of a classroom has to be inclusive and respectful of differences while still being challenging. If a student knows their teacher cares and is invested in their life, it makes all the difference. Students want curriculum that speaks to their personal histories and represents a variety of perspectives. Think more Howard Zinn and less Founding Fathers. Also, every young person we talk to wants to go to college and needs their teachers, principals, and parents to help guide the way. If you ask a teacher how to fix the opportunity gap, they will most likely tell you that the nation as a whole is putting too much on the teacher's plate. Schools are overcrowded and underfunded, leaving teachers overworked and exhausted. They might say that it starts at home. Students need their families to instill a love of learning from an early age and be there for support throughout their school careers. We heard several teachers say it's hard to teach students who come to school hungry or to teach students who are constantly struggling with issues at home. A teacher would also ask for more freedom and flexibility in their curriculum. Think less standardized testing and more project-based learning and assessment.
If you were to ask a parent to fix the opportunity gap, they will tell you the schools need more funding. As long as our neighborhoods are segregated by race and class, and our schools depend on levies and bonds that are proportional to a neighborhood's income bracket, our schools will continue to struggle with unequal resources. The state helps in some degrees, but we can do better. It's written into Washington State's Constitution that it's our paramount duty to adequately fund our public education system. Yet we're still lagging behind the rest of the nation. If you were to ask a policymaker or politician how to fix the opportunity gap, they would most likely speak to the stalemate nature of bipartisanship and political games that make sweeping changes tedious and slow. They would point to conflicts between two major camps, teachers' unions and education reformers, who constantly struggle to find policies they can agree to work together on. However, despite the overwhelming nature of the problem, we know that we can close the opportunity gap and end disproportionate discipline problems. There are clear examples of students, teachers, schools, districts, and states that have turned the tides and begun the work to close the gaps. We also know that Washington is amongst the states that have the most work to do. A recent report by the Center for Education showed that at the rate Washington State is going, it would take us 105 years to close the gap. One immediate solution is to rethink zero-tolerance policies towards school discipline.
To summarize, we started off our podcast series by looking into gaps in academic achievement on standardized tests and on graduation rates. We found that school culture, curriculum, and a student's relationship to their teacher heavily influenced their experience at school. We saw that school districts that made intentional efforts to work on issues of truancy and unequal suspension and expulsion saw promising results. We then took a look at how discipline policies can and have increased students' chances of exiting school prematurely. We saw that schools implemented no second chances into their discipline policies with a goal of keeping students safe, but ended up with drastically unfair results. We looked at the financial costs when students drop out, for students themselves, but also for taxpayers. Lastly, this podcast explored how the opportunity gap and disparities in discipline hurt students of color and students from lower-income households by permanently disenfranchising large portions of the youth population. We explored that juvie not only puts a student way behind in their education, but also potentially bars him or her from receiving important social services later in life. We see that our public education system is broken, and in some cases, the most vulnerable students are the ones who are hurt the most. For most folks listening, this may not be the first time you've been introduced to these concepts. We're sure it's not the last time you'll hear the phrase school-to-prison pipeline. But we do hope we've achieved our goal, to continue an honest and candid discussion on one of the most pressing issues plaguing our public school system. If you'd like to learn more about the school-to-prison pipeline, or about the League of Education Voters, or Our American Generation, please look us up on the web. Thanks for listening.